that you accursed or very soon to be accursed? Let's get this live podcast at the Canada Pensions and Benefits Regional Conference underway here. I'm David Hurley, and in the highly unlikely event you've never listened to our pod, I know, it's very hard to believe, there's something I got to warn you about right now. The show is called Curse of Politics, and the double entendre is just so fucking intended. Because we tend to swear just a little bit on this program. Whip smart political insight laced with humor and profanity. It's kind of our thing. If that doesn't sound like your thing, well, goddammit, I don't know what to tell you. Maybe take that attractive lanyard and see yourself off to one of those highly productive pensions and benefits breakout sessions. So let me introduce you to the people who put the cuss in disgust, our political panel. Scott Reed, right there.
Hi.
Scott is one of Canada's most sought-after crisis and issues managers. He's been a senior advisor to Prime Minister Paul Martin and counseled CEOs, senior execs, and political leaders at every level. He's seen and heard all over TV and radio, regularly published in The Globe and Maclean's. Scott Reed is the king of all political media.
Yeah.
Jordan Leichnitz has over two decades of experience in progressive political strategy and campaigns at every level of government. She spent 10 years on Parliament Hill in senior strategy positions for the NDP, including Deputy Chief of Staff. Jordan is currently Canada Program Manager for the Friedrich Ebert Stiff Tongue Foundation, which is my absolute favorite German political foundation. And Corey tonight. Corey is the guy who makes Doug Ford soft and cuddly, and ultimately very, very electable. He's had two decades in public affairs, including director of comms for Prime Minister Stephen Harper. Corey was campaign manager for Premier Ford's landslide victory on Ontario in 2018, and he was the leading force behind the Premier, increasing his majority 4 years later. And if you don't know me, I enjoy Lemon Heart Rum, the Saskatchewan Rough Riders, and Hawkins Cheesies. And I've worked on campaigns and campaign strategy since the early 80s, advising Ralph Goodale, Paul Martin, and Kathleen Wynne, among lots of others. So we're here today to talk for about an hour about some politics, and then at the end of it, we'll take some questions or comments from the floor, should there be some. We're going to be at this beautiful Algonquin resort in St. Andrews-by-the-Sea. We're going to be talking about Manitoba's brand new NDP premier, the first First Nations provincial premier in Canada's history. Then we're going to head back here to Atlantic Canada and talk about the shifting political sands here, both federally and provincially. And we're going to touch base in the United States and see what's happening in the race for president down in the United States, whether there's going to be any surprises in that or not. And finally, that glorious son of Atlantic Canada, Gordon Pinsent, will round out the show with our Hey Yous. So let's get started. Jordan, Manitoba election was this week.
Woo!
Right?
Feeling it.
Take a victory lap. Tell us how that went down.
Yeah, well, it went down very, very well for the New Democrats. And I think that what's, you know, we were chatting a little bit before the show, and what's so sweet about the victory is that it wasn't a luck victory. This was a victory born of hard work and good strategy and real discipline on the campaign trail. So I think you had a situation, obviously, where going into the election, the Manitoba PCs were very low in the polls, and this wasn't just under Heather Stephenson. This is a legacy also of Brian Palliser. People really felt like the healthcare system wasn't working for them. You know, during COVID, of course, in Manitoba, they had to airlift people out to ICUs, and there was the closure of emergency rooms, and people were really feeling the impacts of that in their communities. So walking in, it was advantage NDP, and the campaign was a tough one. So the New Democrats, I think, made some really smart choices. The first was that they stuck with just unbelievable single-minded discipline on their message around healthcare. And it wasn't healthcare just in an abstract sense. It wasn't healthcare at a values level. It was extremely concrete commitments. We're going to reopen these three ERs that, you know, just happened to be in important target seats in Winnipeg that were closed. And that's going to make a difference in your life. We're going to hire doctors and nurses for those. So these were like tangible commitments that people really got on board with and felt. They also made sure not to cede the affordability ground to the PCs, which is something that sometimes in NDP campaigns can happen, but they didn't do that. They had some nice little offers on cuts in the gas tax, on hydro rates and things like that that people could really look to for their pocketbooks. And they didn't engage, they didn't bite on any of the culture war pieces that were put out by the Stephenson campaign. And I think we can talk some more about the failings of that campaign. But really, there was a choice made on the PC side to move away from some of those pocketbook issues and focus instead on crime, focus on not doing the landfill search for the remains of the Indigenous women. And then their closing argument ended up actually moving them even further away from their voters, arguably, where they, you might have seen the ad where they said, don't worry, when you get into the polling booth, no one knows what you're doing, so you don't have to be ashamed of voting for us. And it turns out that was a really shit closing argument. So you have to look like maybe people might want you to win.
You're alone.
So
you can vote by yourself.
That's right, with your sad, embarrassing...
Your pants buckled or not, it's up to you. It's very creepy.
We'll never know. So I think all those things came together. Of course, there's other organizational stuff. A lot of work went into modernizing the Manitoba NDP's voter identification and get out the vote operations in the last 2 years, and that paid off in spades. You have early voting in Manitoba, which effectively means that you have like a 10-day election day, right? So parties now really need to do their voter identification, and then they start their get out the vote operations at the beginning of the advance vote. So it's like a rolling election day. And so they did that very well. So all of it came together to get the really great result that Wab Kanu had. And I think, it's very much a victory of his making. He brought that party back from death in 2016, 2017. And I think what we see today is the result of that work.
Yeah. Now, Corey, the thing that's interesting is, as Jordan says, the NDP were talking mostly healthcare. The Conservatives laterally in the campaign were talking about crime, some other issues. How come nobody was talking about cost of living, which is undoubtedly the biggest issue in Manitoba?
Yeah, I think it was a big strategic error on their part to not make that a bigger play. I thought it would have been smart for them to join Premier Eby and Premier Ford in talking about interest rate increases and shaking their fist at the Bank of Canada a bit. There are a number of things I think they could have done that would have been newsworthy and helped shift towards a more of an economic narrative. All things being equal, you have an election campaign where the primary issue people are thinking about going to the polls is healthcare. That's not going to be good for conservative governments. With one historic example in Nova Scotia, but aside from that, I can't think of any other one where that's been the case. So I think that was a miss. But I think what happened in the campaign was not tremendously meaningful. Campaigns matter, but I think the goose was largely cooked before the writ was dropped. If you were to say where the most movement happened in the 6 months leading up to the election, it actually favors the PCs. They still lost badly, but they were 20 points behind and on track to get 7 to 9 seats. I think the strategy for the PCs was more to try to save the furniture. And I think they largely did. But it would have taken some level of divine intervention, I think, to have had an outcome other than the one that we saw in terms of who was going to win the election campaign. In a campaign, you might be able to shift 10 points. You successfully shifted at 15 in 2014, which is probably the largest victory I can think of in modern provincial politics, but to move at 20 points, I think is just it's a bridge too far.
Just one thing, just to stay, Corey, with you for a second. You talked on a previous Curse of Politics about Heather Stephenson.
Yep.
And what a genuine prairie woman she was. Friendly, open, big-hearted, gregarious. That is how her friends are describing her today.
Yep.
Right? And that is not remotely the person that was presented to Ontario, to Manitobans in the election campaign. What do you know about that or think about that?
Well, I think when you're a government that's seeking a third term and, that has a pretty thin list of accomplishments, You know, the only way that you're going to get reelected is to go very hard negative and to try to denormalize the leader and of the other party and make it impossible for people to vote for them. And so that is, by definition, going to be a very negative, very elbows-up campaign. And I think the description of Heather that I've offered before, I think is very accurate. If you were to say, hey, Central Casting, you know, give me a nice prairie woman who is, you know, sort of positive, upbeat, etc. You know, all of those things are fantastic, you know, personality characteristics, but they don't jive well with this sort of negative attack ad-driven campaign that I think they were really, you know, forced into. I don't think there's another strategy that would have yielded a better result for them in terms of saving the furniture around this. So, you know, I think it was always going to be a bit of a personality versus campaign strategy mismatch with respect to the leader and the type of campaign they were going to have to run. You know, that said, I think it could have been a lot worse for the PCs. And, you know, and I think, you know, if I were to say that put a positive spin on the overall election result, obviously I'm a conservative and would like to have seen Heather win and to see
okay,
the
you
piece.
Don't have to be embarrassed.
But I think having Wad Canoe as the first Aboriginal leader of a province on the prairies in particular is something that I think I hearken to, like the Obama election is something with a similar nature that I think there's something that everybody in the electorate can celebrate about that accomplishment. And you know, I think everyone is in the country and in the province is going to wish them well and hope that process goes well for them. I think it speaks well of the Manitoba electorate and Canadian politics generally.
Times have changed, man. Growing up in Regina in the 70s, you could never have imagined it. You just was inconceivable. Scott, I want to pick up what Corey said about how it could have been worse for the PCs. One of the things I'm seeing a lot of after the election is people crowing, oh, these terrible tactics that the PCs employed backfired on them, and they didn't work, and thank God that's true, and we're, you know, it's still good old Canada, and that kind of stuff doesn't work. You know, I don't know about that.
Right.
I don't know about that. I saw polls halfway through the campaign that showed the NDP with a 10-point lead. I saw polls on the eve of the election that showed the NDP with an 8-point lead, and they won by 3 points.
Yeah.
Right? So I'm not sure that shit didn't work.
No, I don't think it does. I don't think that argument is valid, I should say. I think the argument to dismiss the efficacy of those tactics is really, you're missing the point. Unfortunately, perhaps, sadly, whatever. But actually, no, can I just say, before we go, whoever is organizing this and brought Pop Shop here. So phenomenally grateful. I've had 3 black cherries. It's the first time since I was 8 years old. I'm going to have to stop twice to go to the bathroom. But I am in heaven. Getting back to negative campaigning.
Don't sugarcoat it, Scott.
Yeah. Boom. So a couple of things. Just more broadly, I think, and I'll come back to the negative thing because I think it tells a story. First, I thought this is an interesting election, and it has implications, I think, elsewhere for lots of provinces in particular, possibly federally also, in that this is one of those campaigns. Sometimes campaigns turn on specific decisions, tactics, a debate performance, something, you know, like there's a moment or whatever. This was like just a big, muscular fist fight over framing the campaign. And as you say, like you look at that and you think, well, going in with the numbers, why wouldn't there be a fetching chance that you could frame this debate and the ballot question over who do you trust more when it comes to attacking the issue of affordability? And that probably would have advantaged the Conservatives. And the fact that the NDP were able to triumph on making it about healthcare, I think, you know, really gave them, you know, like it's a framing win. Right? And it's a strategic win. And maybe partly that was owed to the...
But wait, can I just jump in?
Yeah.
And say, progressive politicians watching this, though, if they're going to try to absorb the lesson, one of the first things Canoe did was promise to cut taxes.
Yes.
Yes.
Right?
So he inoculated himself, gave himself permission to talk about those other, make healthcare the priority. The other thing, and Jordan has pointed this out on previous pods, I say that only in case someone here has listened to the pod, otherwise I would take full credit for the argument. He didn't just say healthcare. Like, he said emergency rooms, right? Like, he went right to, like, what's the bleeding scab in the healthcare system? Probably not just there. I would think in a whole ton of places, but certainly it was true there. And so we went at that. So they won a framing battle. I don't know if the conservatives decided not to join that battle, that they thought that they could win better on crime. They thought maybe crime was so top of mind that it would work for them, combined with sort of feeling anxieties of a Wab Kanu in his background, and maybe that gave them, you know, they could surf some unstated prejudice. I don't know what the play was, but they lost the framing battle, and it lost them the campaign. And, you know, why wasn't Heather Stephenson running? It's like, you know, I'm a nice person. Everybody likes me better than anybody else. Well, it's pretty goddamn hard to win an election by saying I'm likable. You're not very likable when you're 20 points behind. Like, that is not a how do I pick up ground. Just wandering around saying, just wanted to stop in and tell you that you look nice, I look nice, I think we should spend some nice time together. People are like, okay, thanks, moving right along. So it's not going to get you to cement that, you know, to close that 20-point gap. And so I look at the campaign, and I did find, you know, there was that bingo card ad, you know, with, you know, Wab Kanu, two crimes, this guy's a criminal, these people are, like, you know, really surfing on the line of, you know, playing to anti-Indigenous prejudice. You saw the startling ad at the end of the campaign. Hey, man, you're alone in that booth. You don't have, it literally said, you're not going to get judged by anybody, right? Just go crazy in there. Vote for us. Something bigoted. Right on, brother. You go. But I look at it and I go, the only reason they did those things, and I'm not defending them, but just as clinical campaign professionals, I think the reason they went there were those are the things that were available to them that their research suggested were most likely to help. And it probably is why they're at 3, not 17. It's a sad thing, and it's a remarkable thing that he withstood it. Last thing on Wab Kanu, like, man, it is remarkable and admirable that we have a guy, a Perry premier, who's a Indigenous, but Jesus, he's going to be freighted with a lot, you know? Boy, he's got a load so much heavier than others, right? You know, anytime people say, you're the first, you're the example, you're the role model, you know, boy, that's going to make life really hard. So, you know, have a thought for the guy.
Yeah, I was going to say, just to build a little bit on what Scott was saying, I do see a lot of progressives coming to the conclusion that the result of the election means that the tactics the PCs used didn't work. And as much as I, like, wish in my heart of hearts that was true, I think that the popular vote shows that that wasn't actually necessarily the case. The PCs were betting on a silent majority of folks that were going to respond to some of those dog whistles, but I think they did get a silent minority in the end.
Right.
So I think that we have to use caution when we're interpreting those results and what they mean about that type of negative campaigning. It does mobilize a certain part of the electorate, and it also turns people off. Like, this is something that's really critical in negative campaigning, is it's as much about keeping the other guys' people home as it is about bringing your own folks out. So I think that even though this will probably be a campaign that we look back on as a bit of a litmus test of nastiness in Canadian politics, and particularly because of the subject matter of some of the ads and some of the choices that were made, I don't think it's the last we're going to see of those tactics, unfortunately.
Well, you know, I mean, Corey's going to jump in here in a minute. I'm just going to say, my whole life in politics, people talk about negative ads and all that kind of stuff all the time. It is way easier to convince people that a politician is shitty than to convince them that they're good. Right?
Yep.
And to a degree to which campaigns are about saying to people, as a leader, hey, I'm good. Right? It's a lot easier to say, don't worry about me. The other guy sucks. Mm. Right? Like, it's... And that's where we're at.
Well, how many focus groups have we all sat through where you toss up four different ad options? There's two positive and there's two negative, and everybody watches them all, and then you ask the focus group at the end, so what did you think of those? Oh, negative campaign. It's so terrible. Don't like it at all. It's really off-putting. And then you say, okay, so what messages did you retain from those four ads I showed you? And it's like, well, you know, the guy's a liar, he's a cheater, he, you know, like, all of the negative stuff is what is punched through, and you ask him, what do you think is believable in these ads? It's also all the negative stuff. So, you know, we vote with our own consciousness in terms of what we actually absorb and what actually punches through. And as you say, having someone believe something negative about a politician, not so hard. I just wanted to touch a little bit around the efficacy of these things and something that Jordan just mentioned, because I think it's right on point. Negative ads are as much about voter suppression as they are voter persuasion. And it drives people to just not turn out and vote. You know, what was surprising to me is this was clearly a change election in Manitoba, but a change election with 52% voter turnout. That is unusual, and that is a sign that I think the negative advertising did have an effect, because normally in a change election, you're going to see much higher voter turnout. You tend to see lower voter turnout when incumbents get handily reelected. So we were like 48 last time in Ontario for Ford, but, you know, people didn't feel compelled because they thought he was going to win anyway. And so you'll see that on, you know, re-elections, you'll tend to see voter turnout, and in change elections, it should go up. But this is a change election where voter turnout was very low. So it was actually about the same as what it was when Palliser was re-elected. So, you know, I think that's a bit telling in terms of the efficacy of it. I think those who want to draw conclusions about what works and what doesn't, I've heard a lot of analysis out there, and I think most of it is bullshit.
Exactly.
I think we'd also be remiss if we didn't talk about the complete collapse of the Manitoba Liberals.
Yeah. Oh, shit.
Yeah, well, but there's one...
I thought you trying to walk away.
Just on this point, I think this is, you know, one of these areas where I think the issues that the Conservatives were using as wedges and the attacks that they were making were an accelerant to the collapse of the Liberals. Because while they motivated Conservative voters to come out and vote and to suppress other voters from voting for the NDP,
they were polarizing in a way that caused
a progressive voters to unite and feel more motivated to come out around those issues. So, you know, some of this is sort of apropos to New Brunswick right now. You know, issues around trans-related issues in the education system, for instance. You know, these are issues that are polarizing. And it may even be polarizing in, you know, in that case, like a 60-40 in favor of Stephenson's position. But the 40 on the other side, you know, were split between two parties and tended to push them together behind the NDP. So I think those wedge issues, you know, while they worked, they also had sort of a whipsaw effect on the other side in terms of uniting progressive voters around the NDP.
Liberals have ever been particularly strong in Manitoba. But that's been their best prairie province over the years, and sometimes they've been impactful in the city of Winnipeg, right, with their vote. But you know, the center is disappearing in this country.
Yes.
Yeah.
Right. And this is an example. The election was another example of it.
I wanted to lay one other thought on the table. Particularly, I know you want to segue to talking about Atlantic Canada and provincial politics and how it looks here, and I do wonder, to the very first point that you brought up and Jordan brought up, I wonder if you're looking provincially right now and you're an opposition party, do you look at Manitoba and say, well, that's a transportable phenomenon, I can actually use that? So if, for example, Higgs was, you know, if he does call a snap election, you end up in an election here, you know, will an opposition party go, you know, let's talk about street level healthcare. Like, let's take healthcare, you know, before, like, you know, people federally, and you've made this joke, you know, you think, oh, well, there was a healthcare deal, so that's fixed now, right? But it doesn't feel fixed in communities, and at the provincial level, it sure doesn't feel fixed. So, you know, would you see people say, like, if we can get granular and say, it's not working, there's money out there, you're underspending the budgets that are allocated, and we can do a lot more, and we need to do more on that sort of front level where it's, you know, getting doctors to every community, or whether it's, you know, emergency rooms, that kind of stuff. I wonder if you might see people say, I'm just going to cut out that magazine article and bring it right here to my province as a campaign strategy. And I don't think it would be the dumbest thing in the world to do.
Right. You could do worse.
Right. All right, let's talk about Atlantic Canada for a bit. In 2015, after the federal election, the Liberal Party held every federal seat in Atlantic Canada and governed every province in Atlantic Canada. There's now one Liberal provincial government in Atlantic Canada, and the polls are indicating that the federal fortunes are turning ultimately as well, and that Liberals could be in trouble in some ridings out here in Atlantic Canada. Corey, what do you think is going on?
I think a number of things. You know, when you own it all politically, you own it all. You own it all in terms of outcomes. You own it all in across the board. You don't have any fingers to point to anyone else. So, and I think life hasn't been wonderful in a lot of the country, including Atlantic Canada, especially around cost of living and the economy. And when you look at what the drivers are for Poilievre's surge in the polls in the region, that's what's been driving it. And more specifically, with a very fine point put onto the cause being around carbon tax and the carbon tax increases. So it's not just, you know, things aren't going well, but able to ascribe that to a fairly specific policy. They've been advertising here long in advance of where they have anywhere else in the country. You know, been running ads on carbon tax in Atlantic Canada for what, like the better part of a year.
Yeah.
And you're seeing the outcome of that, and they've been running unopposed. There's no counter-narrative. There's no Liberal Party ad campaign that's putting a counter-narrative out there. So they've been able to run the whole field and being able to expand their base from nothing, you know, because look, the Stephen Harper years, which I
was... This region was scared of this modern Conservative Party.
Well,
Atlantic Canada rejected it from the beginning.
A culture and of defeat and dependency. Wasn't that the famous Harper quote, which basically knocked 15 points off the party for more than a decade? Mm. So, you know, there was a big hole for the Conservatives to dig out of. But, you know, the latest polls would seem to indicate they've done that. I'll maybe tie that to, you know, what I would suggest for Premier Higgs. And here, you know, he's a government that's been around a bit. There's issues, you know. But I'd be trying to hitch my wagon to the Poilievre train on some of these cost of living issues. And I would be talking way more about the carbon tax. I would be talking way more about those and almost be running as, your federal conservative, franchise here in the province of New Brunswick, as that's where there's greater political momentum and probably less baggage. So for what it's worth, I think it's cost of living driven and carbon, you know, particularly the carbon tax.
It's pretty existential territory for the Liberals out here, Scott. I mean, first of all, I mean, the West is so bad that you actually need a critical mass of seats here to make the math work. It isn't just a nice thing to have, it's a need to have.
Yes.
Right? And, you know, it's also pretty baked into the Liberal Party DNA that we're the party of Atlantic Canada.
Yeah, and I don't know that the messages have registered. I don't know that the threat has, I don't know if they brought it in on, Liberal radio yet. It hasn't reached people's ears on Parliament Hill. Because if you are in Ontario, and if you're in Ottawa and you work for the government, I always talk about how, the West seems so far away and all that. Well, the Atlantic is feeling pretty far away these days. Like, I don't think they get how precise a threat the carbon tax is and how it has landed here uniquely and across all the provinces, bang, and it is things. So I think the Liberals, in the region, the federal Liberals, but it will bleed over maybe to a bunch of the provinces and the provincial parties. I think they've got pain that's sharp and heavy, right? The sharp is the carbon tax. Like, and it's freaking fucking sharp, right? Like, it is people like 15 cents at the pump, like people feel it and it causes them discomfort and it is bleeding. And then I think it's heavy because there's just been, partly the traditional in and out thing. So, we've seen Conservative governments sweep out in the Atlantic over the years provincially. And then, you see the renewal the other way too federally and all that. So you've got that kind of historic heaviness. I think the brand has a slightly different definition. I think there's a lot less you know, loyalty to the brand. The NDP are players in all sorts of pockets now when they didn't used to be green some places. And so if you're the Liberals and you're saying federally and you're going, well, like we're behind, and so like let's start taking steps and let's get this party started in places where we need to, you know, make progress, you'd say, well, let's start with the Atlantic, right? That's where the affinity would be the most natural. That's where we could make some real progress in bringing it back. But that all that weight...
Well, they don't seem very flexible on that. Like, there's a lot of ways in which that carbon tax thing could have gone down. They could have negotiated that. They could have done all kinds of things. If they were focused on their political vulnerability here, they would have done that differently.
Well, and this is what I mean. So, like, you have all this weight, but the sharp thing, the stick, the knife that's at your throat of the carbon tax, you can't take it away if you're the Liberals. So, I mean, so the ability to say, all right, well, we're going to get this thing moving in the other direction. We're going to start fighting back. I don't know how successful that climb back can be in the Atlantic.
The
carbon tax,
the current Liberal leader can't.
Yeah.
You're asking about a policy change, and you're suggesting.
Yeah, no, but I think the only way I agree with you, but I'm just saying the only way that I think that the federal Liberals can back away from a carbon tax with any credibility or even entertain it as a notion is if Trudeau's looking down the barrel of defeat and decides to step down before the next election, and you have a change in leadership. I think that provides an opportunity to tack on that would be credible, but.
I think you underestimate how the orthodoxy of the Federal Liberal Party has really become centered around climate. I really do think that. Like, in Pierre Trudeau...
Really? Because the orthodoxy of the Liberal Party used to be about winning.
Yeah.
About
winning. Well, and I was going to say...
I think that. Yeah. You know, like when Pierre Trudeau was prime minister, the orthodoxy of the party shifted. Obviously, it's about winning, but it shifted around constitutional politics. Like, that's what it was. And now I think the driving policy definition of the Federal Liberal Party, its sense of cause to cri de coeur, is around climate. And I don't know how you reverse on that policy, and I don't know how you win with that policy, like the carbon tax.
So, you know, as an outsider looking in on Liberal Atlantic Canada, which New Democrats so often are, I think one thing that is so striking and I think also really contributes to the problems Liberals are having here is that reliance that they have on Atlantic Canada as a base, and it is taken for granted. And at a certain point, people in Atlantic Canada look up and say, we have a massive footprint within this government, within this caucus, and it's getting us the square root of sweet fuck all in terms of attention and solutions to our problems. And that is a very hard ship to turn around, because the attention of the Trudeau government is all focused elsewhere. This was a region that they could count on. And they've been so ineffectual in understanding exactly how the affordability crisis has overlapped with existing, for example, in Newfoundland, the energy affordability crisis in Newfoundland that was so painful for people even prior to the carbon tax coming in. And so these things are all interlocking together in a way that's just really unfavorable for them. And they're not showing any ability to pivot into that. And I think we're seeing that provincially too, and in terms of the center starting to maybe certainly not vanish, but erode here in Atlantic Canada as well. You know, we've got the NDP's numbers are up in Newfoundland, they're up in Nova Scotia. By-election in Nova Scotia this August, the Liberals lost a seat they'd held for 22 years and fell to third place. New Democrats were second. Like, this is not the shit you want to see in your tea leaves when you're turning the cup over. But there doesn't really seem to be a lot of ability to chart a path through.
Okay, but it is also fair for me to come back to you and say that despite some pretty interesting polling numbers in Newfoundland, by and large, I mean, the NDP in 2015, when Trudeau swept through this place and took every seat, he knocked off people like Megan Leslie. He knocked off people like Jack Harris, right? He knocked off NDP titans who were huge contributors to the NDP caucus. I don't sense that the NDP are really charging at this place either. To me, it feels like the Conservatives are the people that are trying to win this region.
Yeah, I think certainly the NDP presence is smaller than the Conservatives, that's for sure. But, you know, on the federal scene, I think they've always been very strategic in where they invest their resources in building. And so, for example, right now, you know, federally, the Halifax seat's likely going to be up for grabs. And that's one where that, you know, they're going to be putting an excellent candidate in there. They're going to be putting a lot of money, a lot of resources. But, you know, it's not going to be across the region, right? There are pockets that are much more winnable for New Democrats than others. And so that's places like Halifax, Dartmouth, St. John's. Those are places where you're going to see the most resources going into in a pretty strategic way. But the infrastructure that was there prior to 2015, you know, is life is being breathed back into that, right? So I think that the fact that it's not unknown to those voters, there is comfort with New Democrats there, certainly, you know, I think about landslide Jack Harris, as we used to call you, we would win with 76%, right? So it's not unknown to people in Atlantic Canada to vote New Democrat, and in fact, I think that they often see that as pretty good bang for their electoral buck.
Right. So while we're talking about Atlantic Canada, it seems to me that one of the biggest recent developments in Canadian politics started here in New Brunswick with Higgs, and that is the pronoun issue, the gender identification issue. And it's now become an issue in Saskatchewan. It was an issue in the Manitoba election. It's an issue in Ontario to some extent. This is something that conservative politicians feel they've got a winner on. And it started here, some allegation that the advisors aren't from here that brought the idea to Higgs. But it started here. And so what it seemed to me from the outset is that there was massive institutional resistance to Higgs doing that. Cabinet ministers resigning, caucus members resigning, widespread condemnation, etc. But he's not gone. And I think he's doing better in the polls than he was. And I think he's ahead of Susan Holt. And so this is, again, one of these things. And maybe I'll just start with you, Jordan, about how would you suggest that progressives take on an issue like this? Because the reality is, the reason it's a good political issue is everybody agrees with Higgs on this. Like, voters overwhelmingly agree with Higgs on this. And when they hear the politicians, that they might be liberals and they might be New Democrats. And when they hear New Democrats and liberals saying, well, that's wrong, parents don't have a right to know, it makes them not change their mind and agree with the liberals or NDP. It makes them question whether the NDP and the liberals are living on the planet Earth. So how do you deal with an issue like this?
Yeah, this is a super challenging issue to deal with, and I think, you know, and I'm going to leave aside off the bat that the actual meat of the policy, you know, is not based in fact, is morally repugnant and quite harmful to kids, all of which is true. But in terms of the politics of it, the framing of parental rights is really, really persuasive and powerful. And that meets the nod test for most people who aren't deep into discussions about gender and so on. And I think that the challenge for progressives is to mount a counter to that that doesn't go out and tell people how wrong and bad they are. It's instead to build on areas of broad public agreement. And if you look at some of the polling around this, and Angus Reid did a pretty good deep dive on this in September, and if you look across the political spectrum, there are two really big areas of agreement across the public, really no matter where you sit on the issue. And the first is that people do tend to believe that trans people face more discrimination than other groups of people. And the second is that most parents, by about a majority of about 60%, say that if their child came out to them as trans, they would support them. And so those are areas where I think you could begin to build from, that there is some of that inherent understanding and connection on the issue. But at the end of the day, I think you're gonna need to make a case that the premiers who are taking up this issue with, and I'm gonna put forward in a slightly different camp, but where you've got Mo, you've got Higgs and Stephenson, if you look at when they picked up this issue, they each and every one of them picked up the issue when they were in the polls. They picked up the issue as a way, I think, to move off of some of those affordability things. And so to circle back to what we talked about in Manitoba, I think the important thing is for those parties is to, you know, consider where the voters actually are going to be, whether it's on those values issues or whether you're going to reach them a little better with an affordability message that deals with their lived lives. And in terms of opposing it, I think it's really about getting politicians out of interfering in kids' education for their own purposes. And it's mounting the accusation that way, because you're not going to win on the terrain of do parents have rights around this. That is not a favorable discussion for progressives to have, regrettably.
Right. You know, Scott, when Kretschmann was the leader of the party, federally.
I remember.
You remember?
I do.
Big fan. You were a big fan. You chaired the fan club one
year. You know me. I am the son of Wally Chrétien.
He did not lead on these issues.
No.
Right? He would get to the place he was supposed to get to in progressive terms, but he would get there when the public got there and not any earlier than the public got there. Right?
Yeah.
Like, remember, that government was opposed to same-sex marriage before it was in favor of same-sex marriage.
Yep.
Well, I remember.
Right? So, but that, Jordan, seems smart to me. I mean, politically. Mm-hmm. Right? Like, this is just an issue, it feels to me, Scott. Like, if you just come out and you say, well, I'm going to do the right thing from a progressive standpoint, I'm going to defend these kids, and I'm going to wade into this fight, it's just like walking into a political wood chipper. Like, you...
But, the problem, though, with that comparison is that he had the luxury of waiting for those issues to come to him and watching to see where the parade was headed, and then he jumped in front of it when it felt like it was the fortuitous moment. Now what's happening is these issues are being presented and almost manufactured as a point of public policy urgency. It's not, you know, it's not like, oh my God, like this is just sweeping across our countries, our communities, and therefore must be addressed. It's... No, this is a good wedge. This is a sharp bit of pain I can place on my opponents. And so the Chrétien, if you're being confronted with it, the Chrétien strategy, you know, the Franklin Delano Roosevelt, you know, the Mackenzie King sort of like, let's, you know, sit around and let the wind move and then we'll follow. That option is unavailable to you. You're being presented with it. And so I guess my advice would be this. You got to do a couple of things, but fundamentally, if you're, if this thing is flying at you hard because Higgs has brought it up, or Mo has brought it up, or somebody else has brought it up, well, you know what the perils are. You know that if your argument is rooted in parents should not know, you're going to lose that debate 70-30 over and over and over again. And so I think, you know, I'll stick with the knife metaphors. You got to grab this knife by the blade and pull it out of their hands. And I think the way you do that, I mean, one, you want to delegitimize it sometimes. You want to call bullshit on them as they're doing it and saying, just understand, right? This isn't because this is an urgent preoccupation of the public. It isn't because this is more important than I'm going to rhyme off nine other issues, that it's like something that is affecting so many people that it must be addressed urgently, that our policy absence on this has been a horrifying oversight. So you try to delegitimize, but that carries you only so far. You ultimately have to go where you are. And when I say grab this knife by the blade, I think what I would do is I would try to adopt the conservative language on it and label on it real fast and say, let's take a common sense approach to this. Okay. So first of all, right, these are people who are feeling victimized and are being victimized. And the fact that we're having to have this argument means that they're more likely to be victimized and we're participating in it. What's the right common sense proposition? The common sense proposition is, as a default policy, parents ought to be informed. But you know what? I fucking trust our teachers. I trust our schools. I trust our principals. I trust the people that are there. And I trust that in that percentage, that small percentage of the small percentage of people where this issue is at, like, where that small group feel like, and you can recognize as a teacher, holy smokes, if I call this kid's parent, this kid's parent, they might be at risk. We got to have a mechanism to ensure that that default common sense policy is matched by a second common sense policy, which is not, we're not going to put that kid in jeopardy. So, you know, that's what we got to figure out. But this, like, let's use trans kids as a fucking cricket bat to smack one another around politically, that is shit.
And just before Corey gets in, I want to add to what Scott said. I think part of this is about saying the quiet part out loud, like, which is why kids might not be disclosing to their parents.
So, Corey, I want to put it to you this way, because as a conservative, you would have some experience at being on the end of wedge issues that you think are irrational but effective.
Yep.
Take guns, for example.
Yep.
Okay? So Liberal Party, every election, uses gun control, attitude about guns, as a wedge issue between conservatives and urban voters generally. You think that that's a bullshit policy and it's just politics. How do you, what is the way to fight it, though, when you're in that situation?
Well, I think, you know, if we want to stay on trans, although I would talk guns all day.
Well, no, sorry, I was actually just using it as a comparative issue, which gets thrown at you as a deliberate political wedge, which this thing is being thrown at.
Yeah, I think there's an element of that being true, but I think, you know, people think that this issue is about trans kids. It's not. It's about the interplay between parents and the education system and who has the best interests of their students at heart, their kids at heart. And that's really at the fundamental level what's playing out, and the proxy for it is around the trans issue. But I don't think that's actually where the head nodding part of it is coming from, because there aren't a lot of parents out there who are dealing with a trans kid at home. And as you know, Jordan pointed out from the polling, you know, almost a super majority of them would be supportive of their child if that was the case for them. So that's not what's worrying for them. They're like, well, I have to sign a parental permission form for my kid to basically go to the washroom at school. Yet, you know, on something this fundamental to their identity and their mental health and all of that, I want to know about those kinds of things if my child's going through that. And I don't believe that the education system writ large has the same level of care or concern for my children that I do as a parent. And that's where I think the power of the issue is. And that's why I think it's so unwinnable. You know, that being said, that issue plays very differently in different provinces. You know, on the parental permission side, I think it's fairly similar across the board, because it's not about the trans piece as much as it is what I was talking about. But I think that you know, the level of social conservative or values in that sort of ethos is different in every province. You know, I would say New Brunswick is probably the most socially conservative province in the country attitudinally. Saskatchewan would be very close second or third. And so places where it's, you know, where those sentiments are higher and where you feel like you're sending your kids to, you know, to school and they're getting a different set of values than those that you're comfortable with, combined with the I know better than you, so you know if there's any interplay on this that is problematic, you know the government is saying I side with teachers, not parents. That's just going to be a shitty equation. So you know I think you're more likely to see these issues come up in provinces where it's a confluence of those two things. I think the one is everywhere. I think the other one is more in some places, and the places where it's more is where you're seeing is come to the fore more prevalent, where it has more prevalence. I think there's also a little bit of a cheap karaoke version of U.S. politics that always goes on in Canada.
Yeah,
and, for sure. And right now,
we're not like a good drag show.
No. Blaine Higgs is singing "Pour Some Sugar on Me" all around the province.
But in the, you know, for instance, the Scheer, Bernier, you know, Kelly Leach leadership and conservatives, you saw a version of sort of Trumpism around immigration playing out within the conservative leadership race that was really you know, imported from U.S. media and U.S. political culture. I think you're seeing some of that happening now around this issue, because the Republican primary is going on and you've got DeSantis and others that are pushing those issues to the fore. And so there's a greater awareness of these things that is not drawn from personal experience. It's drawn from U.S. media and U.S. media coverage. So I think that's another part of what's going on. You know, I don't think this is going to be a huge issue in Ontario, for instance, because I think the way the issue splits is a lot more complicated because of the sort of socio-demographics of the province of Ontario. It's not the clean, clear winner that it is here or is in Saskatchewan for conservative parties in those provinces. It's more divisive, and so there are better things. how would I push back against it? Because this is what I think is largely true everywhere. When you're having trouble, you know, paying for gas for your gas tank, you're having to cancel a family vacation because you don't, you know, the disposable income that you thought was available to you is not there because of higher grocery prices, et cetera. Those are like in Maslow's hierarchy of needs, those are, you know, foundational things. And we're talking about things that are hypothetical, you know, like, yeah, I hear what you're saying about this, but, you know, my kid isn't trans and, you know, but my grocery bill is real. And if they're like my kids, like the fridge door is open more than it is closed. So yeah. Like those issues are way more pressing and urgent and fundamental to the political question. So, you know, I think relevancy and hierarchy becomes a thing. And I think where you see the most effective of pushback, it's probably a combination of what both of you said. You know, I think it's disarming it a bit by saying, hey, on the part that everyone agrees on, which is parents have a right to know what's going on with their kids, I think I would just cede that ground. And on the other part, I would say, look, but shouldn't we be talking about, you know, healthcare or cost of living or, you know, whatever the other issues are that on the issue matrix score, you know, 100x what that issue does. Yeah. So, you know, it doesn't have to define a campaign if you put something else in the window that's more important.
Well, and I think the Manitoba campaign is an excellent illustration, really, of that. And I just want to underline something that Corey's saying, or maybe make it a little more obvious for all of us to watch in Ontario, which is the interplay between this issue and putting the government on the opposite side of teachers ahead of negotiations.
Well, teacher negotiations are the bane of every province's existence. David had similar role in the Wynne government. I don't think there's probably been a premier more favorable to teachers and teachers unions in the Wynne government, and yet they still ran millions of dollars of TAC ads against you in 2018.
Yes.
So, you know, no one likes an ingrate, and the teachers unions are fucking ingrates. So if you're going to, you know, oppose the government no matter what you do, then, you know, you get dealt with in a different manner. But that said, for a conservative government, talking about education is generally something that if you're doing, you're losing. I think the focus is the economy, it's cost of living, it's those kinds of issues in which conservatives have a greater level of trust. Crime, criminal justice issues as well. There's a whole suite of issues that are just, in my view, way clearer wedges and way clearer winners for conservative parties. Now, that's, you know, not universally true. And I think if Premier Higgs is pushing this forward, he's not a stupid man. And his political team can read a poll as well as I or anyone else can. So if they're doing it, there's a reason, and you know, I assume it's because it's popular.
Yeah. Find out.
All right, let's do a lightning round on the U.S. because we're out of time. So this is the lightning round. I'm going to start with you, Scott, and I'm going to present you with this proposition.
Okay.
That the election is going to feature Donald Trump running against Joe Biden, and they're going to be within 50 votes of each other, and it will be a disputed election, and the whole system will collapse into chaos.
Wow, that's
Tell
sunny.
Me, give me some reason to think something other than that might happen.
I'm not that optimistic. I don't think it's going to be that good. Because I think if I accept that Trump and Biden are leading their two parties, then I got three words for you, RFK. I think he's going to fuck it all up and destroy this thing. I think that, you know, that you're going to get enough money and goofy and crazy behind him that it's going to bleed some bleed some votes, and you could end up in a situation where Trump is able to succeed. I'm really, really worried about all of that. What could intervene in that? I will tell you this. I have an answer, my friends. I have an answer. 6 months ago, I went online betting, and I found a casino that would take this bet, right? And the bet is, if Gretchen Whitmer is elected president of the United States as a Democrat, I win $12,000. And it was for a paltry sum of placed cash. And I know that Biden is running. I know that we're getting close to the point where if Biden were to not run, It's very difficult to get everybody on the ballots as candidates and all that kind of stuff. But I just genuinely, a big part of me thinks that Biden will not run. And maybe that's just hope. But I just...
death.
Yeah.
I didn't say it. But I mean, Christ almighty, yeah. Right? I don't think that there's an obvious campaign inoculation against his age. And you can say Trump is also old and Trump is fat and unhealthy and all this stuff. And they say, you know, Biden spends 45 minutes a day on an elliptical or whatever the hell. It's like, look at him. Look at him. Right? He looks like Imhotep. He looks like something somebody's set a spell and he's been raised from a sarcophagus. So I know I'm being ageist, but Jesus H. Christ, he looks really, really old, and that's going to matter. And so I think the answer is, you know, you have to hope that all these convictions and that stuff has a limiting effect on Trump's potency, not with his supporters, but hopefully... It just says to people, it's all crazy. It's going to be all crazy. It's going to be all crazy, all crazy, all crazy. And hopefully, you know, I really hope that, you know, the Democrats are able to elect a lunch bucket, a younger lunch bucket. It's why I like Whitmer, right? She's not always favorable to Canada, but, you know, she's from a swing state. She's a lunch bucket Democrat. She's got ties to labor. She's a woman. I just think you add it all up. She's a governor. Like, you put all those things together, and I go, I would rather take my chances on that. And so I hope that happens. And, you know, what can you say about Trump? Like, the consequences of him winning, like, I literally, like, there isn't anything bad enough you could say about what would happen. It's like, you know, the Batman quote from Michael Caine, right? Some people just want to watch the world burn. I think at this point, he just wants to watch the world burn. There's no telling where he would go if reelected to office.
Yeah. You got a different scenario than the one I'm offering up?
Jesus, no. He's Trump's back, and he's back for revenge. Like, that's it. That's
right.
That's the animating thing behind him, and it's terrifying. I think, look, I mean, I share Scott's hope that the Democrats will come to their senses, but in reality, I don't think it's going to happen.
You do. So you do not believe that Biden is the best candidate they can put forward against Trump?
I don't believe so, no. But I think he's going to run. I think he's going to run, and his age is certainly going to be a factor. I mean, look, his camp clearly believes that it's going to be a pass because it's not a referendum on him, it's a comparison with Trump. And that's their animating theory behind running with him. But I worry about that theory because I think if you look also strategically at, you know, at some of the other choices the Democrats have made, one of the real problems that's happened right now is that with the convictions and the charges and the investigations against Trump, it's now just a sea of crazy, right? Like, everything is an outrage. Everything is an outrage, and so now nothing is an outrage. Like, Trump was out stumping last week talking about shoplifters should be shot on sight, and it didn't make a blip.
He tried to get the law clerk killed the other
right.
day.
Because everything is
go get her.
So like, there is I mean, some of this is just the circus, right, of Trump. But some of this is also how the Democrats have prosecuted the case, and I think that there is an issue with the fact that now there's just a base level of sheer insanity in U.S. politics that voters have come to expect, and so what should be truly outrageous is no longer seen as outrageous. And then the last thing I'll say is that, you know, I think, in the same way that, you know, we all joke about Hillary and her emails now, like, you can see history repeating itself a little bit around the age question in media, right? Like, media is also driving, I think, like, voter interest in that question. Like, it's a bit of a feeding frenzy. And so I think we may end up a bit in the same place. It's, you know, his age, her emails, and then, like, fuck, we have Trump again. So that's what keeps me up.
You? What do you see happening?
Well, I think Biden's going to be the Democratic nominee, almost certainly. There's no indication that from anyone, him, his team, anyone around the Democratic Party, that anyone else is going, that he's going to step down or that anyone else is running. And you don't see anyone preparing to run. So I think that's just total wishful thinking that's going to happen on the Democratic side.
Is.
We're hopeful
now,
people.
Now on the Republican side, I think they're, you know, I share a lot of the same concerns around a Trump presidency. I think it will be destabilizing in a bunch of ways, including for Canada and globally. And I think, you know, the undertones of autocracy and sort of sedition around the Jan 6 stuff, et cetera, that's all deeply, deeply concerning, I think, for everyone. But the only way I think that he's not the next president is if the Republicans nominate somebody other than him. And I think there are a few things to be more hopeful about on that side. I'll do a plug for kind of what I like to view as our brother or sister podcast, Hacks on Tap, with Robert Gibbs and David Axelrod and Mike Murphy. If you like U.S. politics and you like, well, they don't swear, but everything else is kind of
similar. They're pretty nice. They're pretty polite.
They're duller.
You know, one of the things that they often point out, which I think is very true, is the primary process in the U.S. is not an election, and where Trump is sitting in the national polls is not that relevant. It's a series of elections over a period of time in which momentum is gained or lost based on your performance in those. And I think you're seeing some shift in movement in Iowa and New Hampshire. And, like, let's see what happens in that process. But, you know, I don't think it's a foregone conclusion that Trump is the nominee. I think about half the party is pretty committed to him. But, you know, it's not everyone. And that is something that is movable and can be destabilized either through some of the court proceedings going against him, which actually I got to say, you know, as much as this is being driven by the DOJ and Democrats, they're doing him the biggest favor they could, because every time he gets another indictment, he goes up another 3 or 4 points in the polls. So, like, I think the actions around that have actually been an accelerant in a positive way for his campaign in terms of its growth, despite what the intention was, which I think was to create drag on it. It's had the opposite effect. I think it's conclusively shown in the polling to date that that's the case. But, you know, I think if it's a Biden-Trump matchup, Trump will be the president again. And, you know, while they are both elderly, one is energetic elderly. You know, you can go any given day and see Trump crushing a drive on the links and turning to the camera and saying, let's see Biden do that. And you see Biden shuffling around like he's, you know, in a senior's home in Fort Lauderdale rushing to get to the elevator. Like, you know, he doesn't have to worry about driving because he's got the Secret Service to do that. But if he was in your family, you'd be saying, Grandpa, let's have a conversation about whether or not you should have a driver's license anymore. And this is the guy whose finger's on the nuclear button. Like, he's, you know, so when it's like what you said, Jordan, a matchup between not perfection, it's between these two men. It doesn't go well for Biden is the problem. The problem is that when you put them next to each other, despite, you know, what our feelings might be about Trump, for a lot of American voters, they don't think that Biden is competent today. And they have a lot of difficulty imagining what he's going to look like 5 years from now. And when they look at who the VP selection choice is, she's, you know, not the greatest candidate in the history of the world. So, I think it's, you know, it's grim in that I think we're, you know, unless something radical changes, I think we're looking at a very high probability of another Trump presidency.
Agreed. All right. It is time for that great son of Atlanta, Canada, Gordon Pinsent, to bring home this show with our Hey Yous.
Ladies and gentlemen, please return to your seats. The Hey Yous are about to begin.
Scott, fire it off.
All right. My Hey You goes to Justin Trudeau, and it actually picks up a little bit. There's a touch of a theme given the conference, and it's about the Alberta Pension Plan. I think that when you are behind in the polls, when your personal numbers are falling in terms of preference to be the next prime minister, when you find it increasingly difficult to find positions that marshal a large majority of Canadians, a large plurality of Canadians behind you, and you are confronted with an idea that is bad, bad, like trying to pull on the thread of the Canada Pension Plan and unravel it, when you're talking about a proposal that would, without even blinking its eyes or being embarrassed, suggest that Alberta is entitled to 53% of the CPP fund, leaving the other provinces high and dry, having to raise premiums. I just think you look at it and you're Trudeau and you go, well, you know what? This is not a fight where I say, well, I don't want to get back and forth with Alberta. Then it looks like, you know, I'm beating up an Albertan's home team and that'll help Danielle Smith. Screw all of that. This is an opportunity for you to involve yourself in an issue where you have every right to be. It's a grand national institution, the Canada Pension Plan, that we've enjoyed since the 1960s. And it belongs to Canadians, and it also belongs to Albertans. And I think the Prime Minister came out hard as stone on this and said, by God, over my dead body, let's go. It would be an issue around which not a plurality, but a large majority of Canadians and Albertans would be behind him on. So when you find a parade that is loud and attractive and gathering steam down the street, jump in front of it. Don't say, well, let's wait and see where it goes, and then, you know, maybe I'll stop by for the pancake breakfast later. Get in front of the APP parade and hammer away on that thing. I think it's a huge opportunity, and I think it's also the right position that the Prime Minister of our country should be taking.
All right. Jordan, got to hate you.
I do. Also going out to the perennial popular federal Liberals this week. So my hey you pertains also to a theme that might be of interest to some folks at the conference, which is the negotiations around pharmacare with the NDP. So some news out today.
The what? Very fluid.
Right. Very fluid. Some negotiate. They're fluid. The negotiations are fluid. So here's the thing. Here's the thing, friends. Red team friends. You need time. Time is your friend. And the more time that the Liberals can buy with the New Democrats, the better their chances of some semblance of survival. And so if the price is some framing legislation around pharmacare, and again, no one is talking about the whole hog right off the bat. We are talking about setting up a legislative frame. It's not going to cost a penny, okay? Because I can hear Freeland. What you need to be really careful of is walking away from what was one of the top pieces that Singh named as his price, because it will become increasingly awkward for him to stay in the agreement if there is not a sense of progress on this file. So think very carefully about where you draw your lines on this, because the New Democrats have two options before them, and there isn't one that is demonstrably greater than the other. Sticking with the agreement, blowing up the agreement, and if they feel that their hand is forced, you might not like the answer.
Sure. Well, I wanted to do a hey you kind of to the Ottawa Press Gallery, but not in the typical conservative shitty way. And maybe even more singularly to Terry Molesky. Here's my hey you and my gripe. I think that we haven't seen very good coverage of what's been going on with India. I think there's really big issues. You know, we talked about them a lot on the last podcast. We've got, you know, serious issues, and they're longstanding, and they're complicated. And the level of reporting and literacy, you know, literacy in the Canadian public around this and reporting on it by the Canadian media, it's just terrible. Like, it is just so skimming along the surface of it, of an issue that has a lot of depth and a lot of importance, not just today, but it's going to have a lot of importance for our relationship with India and with the Indian diaspora that lives here. We owe it to Canada and to Canadians to have much better coverage. I name Terry Molesky because he's, I think, one of the few Canadian journalists who really delved deep on those issues for a long period of time. And did a service to you know, CBC, mostly where he worked, and to Canada as a whole by providing that coverage. So throwing out the challenge to the Ottawa Press Gallery, let's try to really dig into this. I know everybody's short resources, but find a reporter or two and give them this beat and have some longer standing coverage around this. It really is warranted, and it's not happening today.
Yeah, it's disappeared from the news cycle, basically.
Yeah,
amazing. My Hey You goes out. Word is leaking out today, I think, that a guy named Andrew Bevin is going back to Ottawa to be Chrystia Freeland's chief of staff. Andrew's somebody I know very well. He was Kathleen Wynne's chief of staff and principal secretary when she was the premier. He's smart as a whip. He's good at politics. The government's really behind the eight ball on the economy and on both policy and messaging and communications, and it's the key to any hope they have of winning the next election. So I'm glad my smart friend is going there, but he's got a lot of work to do to help them turn that around. But God bless you, Andrew, for taking that task on. So that's my Hey You for the week. I would like to thank our presenting sponsor, TELUS, and our sponsor, CN, for this podcast. I would like to thank all of you who are in this room listening to us. It was so fun to do a live show. And everybody else who listens either on the internet machine or on YouTube, thanks for listening. And we'll be back next week with more Curse of Politics. We'll see you then.
Not here, exactly.
Not here.